Hello, everyone. Welcome to Our Lives with Shannon Fisher. This is your host, Shannon Fisher, and I'm thrilled to have my guest today. It's Harvey J. Kay, and he is a historian who has written a book about Thomas Paine. His book is called Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. Harvey is the Ben and Joyce Rosenberg Professor of Democracy and Justice Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Green Bay, and he has so much information about Thomas Paine, who has been called the father of the American Revolution, and Paine has been buried and revered and maligned throughout history. So Harvey has a lot to share with us about Paine historically and how his ideas relate to what is happening in politics today. So Harvey, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad to be talking to you. So tell me, what made you decide to write this book about Thomas Paine?
Thomas Paine, when I was 10 years old, in my grandparents' apartment on Eastern Parkway in Brooklyn, New York. And their apartment was in a fairly nice building opposite the Brooklyn Museum. And the way it worked was that whenever my parents would take my sister and myself to Brooklyn to visit my grandparents, I would always hope that someone would take me across the street to the museum. Not that I was a big art buff, but they had an unwrapped mummy at the museum, which any 10-year-old boy could not help but be fascinated by it. So anyhow, but there were times where there was no cousin around, or my father wasn't going to break free. There were times when I couldn't get there. And there were times, however, when I'd be sitting there and I'd know it was time to leave the room. Those were the moments where I was hoping there'd be a cousin around to take me. So I'd wander my grandparents' apartment as if it was part of the museum. You know, each bedroom and the dining room and all these places were like galleries. And I always ended up at the far end of the dining room. It wasn't a huge place, but it was, to me, a far end because I was
You're a
little.
kid, right?
And yeah, and I would plunk myself down at that far end in front of a set of bookshelves where my grandfather, who was a trial lawyer in the city, where he would keep his personal library. And I would always, it was inevitable, I would always end up in this one spot on the, sh there was one shelf where he had books by and about Thomas Paine. And one book in particular absolutely fascinated me. It had a red, white, and blue cover. And this was a book in which an old sort of atheist intellectual made the argument that Thomas Paine was the real author of the Declaration of Independence. Now, believe me, it's absolutely wrong, but to a 10-year-old boy, it seemed like this was the key to history, at least the key to proving that my school teachers were wrong, if you get my drift. So this book became my first kind of fascination as a work of literature, which it was not. And oh, by the way, so as a consequence, I never got 100% on a history test in school because I would always make the case about Thomas Paine instead of Thomas Jefferson. But the thing was that this kicked off this interest in me in Thomas Paine as a 10-year-old. And it wasn't too many, it was a couple, within a couple of years, and it may even have been longer than I recall, than not that I recall, that actually was the case. My grandmother passed away, my grandfather downsized, leaving the larger apartment. And in the downsizing, he handed over to me some of the Thomas Paine books. The book that most fascinated me was lost somewhere. He didn't hand that to me. But there were other books, especially the ones by Thomas Paine, that I held on to, and all the way through high school, whenever I had free time, I would read them or try to read them. And Paine became the sort of, if you like, my childhood hero. Now, when I entered into college and in graduate school, I actually trained mostly in Latin American studies. I had little interest at the time specifically in U.S. history, other than maybe U.S. foreign policy. But after some years, where having originally been a Latin Americanist and then spending most of the 1980s in a whole different direction, dealing with British intellectuals. In the early 90s, I was teaching a course called Rebels and Their Causes here at the university. And my students kept saying, well, you know, we really could use a good book to sort of guide us into this whole question of rebels and radicals. And since I wasn't a U.S. historian, I asked a friend of mine, Paul Buell, a well-known radical historian, if he and I might do a book together where we would edit a collection of biographical portraits of great American radicals, going all the way back to the Revolution, starting with Thomas Paine and coming all the way through to the present. And he came into it with real enthusiasm. And in fact, his wife, Mary Jo Buell, who was very, very well known, still is a very well-known American women's historian, joined me. And we produced this book called The American Radical. Well, in this book, the plan was that Eric Foner, the great American historian Eric Foner, would write the piece on Thomas Paine. And I would write an afterword to the entire volume, since I wasn't really an Americanist yet. But to keep the long story short, it turned out Eric wrote the foreword. Paul and Mary Jo wrote the introduction. I wrote the afterword, but I also ended up writing the Thomas Paine chapter, which was my first, I had written a little bit on American history, but never something specifically about Thomas Paine. And it was great to do it. It was as if this was, this was about 1993. And of course I had graduated high school in 67. So this is quite a few years later. And, the American Radical book caught the attention of an editor at Oxford University Press who was the young adult and children's editor. And she got this idea about launching a series of biographies for young adults, for teenagers, on world figures. And Thomas Paine, having been originally English, having come to the American continent and becoming such a renowned American revolutionary and patriot, that he would make a good starting place, she said, for this series. So anyhow, I wrote this book, which, by the way, is titled Thomas Paine, Firebrand of Revolution. Oxford University Press published it. It's still in print. And it and I will tell you, I'm very proud to say, it won the New York Public Library Award in 2000 for the best book for the teenage. And I was thrilled. I mean, it was so much fun to write it.
That's fantastic.
Well, yeah, it was. I mean, believe me, it was just great because it's illustrated and... it also helped me to learn how to write really for citizens, not just for students and academics, because when you write for, say, a 15-year-old, you have to write in a way that avoids all jargon.
Right.
So I did that book, and I had to figure out, what am I going to do next? And I was walking in the woods with my wife, and I was talking out loud, and I said, I don't want to give up Thomas Paine. I want to write another book on Paine, but I want to do it for adults. And I had this idea. This was the idea I had. There already were two very good recent biographies of Thomas Paine. And I decided we didn't need a full-scale biography, but wouldn't it be fun if I could write a book in which the first part, it would be a sizable book, the first part would be about Thomas Paine's life and labors. Okay, the second part of the book would be the story of how, for 200 years, it seemed, conservatives were doing everything in their power to suppress Thomas Paine's memory. And as we talk later, I'll explain what that was about. But in the third part of the book, I wanted to bring Thomas Paine back to life. What would he have to say to America today? That was the exciting part. And whenever I offered it to all the publishers I offered it to, they thought, wow, this could be fun, but maybe you should take it somewhere else. This went on for a while. And then finally, there are a couple of publishers, at least the editors, got very excited about it. I ended up doing the book with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And I set out, I never forget it, it was a May day right after the end of the semester. Students were gone from the university. It was a really gorgeous day, and I probably shouldn't have been heading to the library, but I went to the library. I was a committed scholar, I thought. I'd go to the library, and I was going to wander the shelves of the American History section just because I wanted to see how Thomas Paine might have been remembered by pulling biographies off the shelves to see how... if the stories of Americans of the 19th and 20th century made any reference to whether or not they had read or were influenced by Paine.
Sure.
Now, the presumption was, and this is the important thing, the presumption was, as you said in the introduction, that Paine was kind of like the forgotten founder, that in spite of his really extraordinary role in the making of the American Revolution, by writing the pamphlet Common Sense and then writing a series of pamphlets known as the Crisis Papers, that really was the sort of pen of the revolution. That in spite of that, because of later things he wrote, there were conservatives, both political and religious conservatives, right, even during Paine's life in the 1780s and 90s and beyond, who were eager to suppress his memory, to as much as they could denigrate his story. And for in all the succeeding generations, over and over again, conservatives did everything they could to suppress his memory. However, that day, I discovered something. I discovered that I was wrong and that all the historians who had written anything about Thomas Paine were wrong. What I discovered was, by pulling these books off the shelf, a very seemingly mundane act, I discovered that over and over again, American liberals, progressives, and radicals, whether they were free thinkers or working men's advocates or even evangelicals, actually, in the early 19th century, abolitionists, the early suffragists from start to finish, progressives and the populists and the socialists later in the century, all the way through American history, every movement that looked back to the revolution to lay claim to the revolution as a way of fighting for freedom, equality, and democracy in its own time, rediscovered Thomas Paine and made use of his words and his example to inspire themselves and their fellow citizens. So in other words, as much as conservatives tried to suppress his memory over and over again, liberals, progressives, and radicals reclaimed his memory, especially radicals, mm-hmm. and made him in many ways the source of their encouragement, the source of, in some ways, their ideas. And so Paine's had never been buried, had never disappeared from American experience. But what's funny is, of course, conservatives tried to suppress the memory of every succeeding radical movement, mm-hmm. but it didn't happen. And Paine, so I read this book, Thomas Paine, The Promise of America, in which I recount his life and labors, and then I go on to tell the story of his life, you might say, through all the way through American history, the way in which his arguments shaped American history. So it became, in a fashion, as I think you mentioned, my love letter to America. And I never did do that third part of the book, Bring Him Back to Life, in part because I felt that he had never really died in the American spirit, that generation upon generation of progressives had laid claim to him and advanced his memory. However, I did have to deal with one very, very strange twist in the story, the one that we live with today, and that is that in 1980, Ronald Reagan, you know, the champion of conservatism and conservative republicanism, he began to quote in his 1980 campaign Thomas Paine at his most radical. That is the line, "We have it in our power to begin the world over again," which was a line in Common Sense that stirred people. Mm-hmm. And in essence, I had to deal with, like, how could it be that in fact, Ronald Reagan, of all people, was the one who also laid claim to Paine, broke with 200 years of conservative politics and ideas, and it literally advanced Paine's memory directly into the conservative movement. So that became, in essence, a sort of challenge. The challenge not only to explain that, but also then to say, well, what do we do now? How do we not only reclaim Thomas Paine, but how do we recover the progressive Thomas Paine in order to pursue the progressive politics of the day?
So, sure. That kind of threw a wrench into the memory of him, because, as you said, it had always been infidels and radicals who had kind of adopted his words and adopted his ideas. So tell the listeners a little bit about what Thomas Paine's ideas were and what kind of role he played in the American Revolution, why he was viewed as such a revolutionary.
Okay, well, the first thing to realize about Thomas Paine, and it's interesting to consider that Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Paine, who were so utterly different, were themselves both immigrants to America, who came to America and became so significant in the story. And a sidebar, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote, of course, the Broadway show, mm-hmm. Hamilton, right? Was asked last year by the New York Times Book Review what book every American should read. And strangely enough, in spite of his having used Hamilton as his hero and champion in that play, he said Common Sense by Thomas Paine.
Wow.
And I thought, in fact, all I could think was, why didn't you do the Broadway show on Thomas Paine? So Paine was born in England in 1737. He didn't actually come to America until he was almost 40 years old. His life story as a boy and as a young man is significant because of the way it prepared him to recognize America's revolutionary potential. For a start, his mother was an Anglican. His father was a Quaker, which was a very, very strange combination, a very strange marriage, given the antagonisms between them. The
yes.
Anglicans were the state church. The Quakers had been a radical movement of the 17th century that had survived and become a pacifist church. And one of the things about that is that it really made Paine sensitive to this whole question of religion and politics and the degree to which state churches truly can oppress people. And this became a part of his thinking. Also, he came to realize that churches themselves were probably misrepresenting God if there was a God. Paine couldn't believe that God could be nearly as brutal as organized religion made him. Anyhow, so this tension between Quakerism or, you know, Friends and Anglicanism is at the heart in many ways of Paine's thinking all the way through his life. But here's the other thing. He came from a family that was not terribly well off, but they did what they could to put him to school, through school, up until about the age of 13. However, at the age of 13, they had to withdraw him from school, and he was apprenticed to his own father. His father was a corset maker, known as a stay maker. That is, people have that image, of course, of women being, you know, tied together with that, you know, corset. So they develop, what is it, the hourglass shape. I mean, a really brutal kind of clothes, underwear.
Definitely.
Yeah, and so Paine learned how to become a staymaker, a corset maker, which an activity he pursued for several years. But you can imagine a young boy in the late 18th century is eager for adventure, eager to make his own way in the world. And at a certain time, I think he was about 19 years old, he ran away to the coast to sign on as a privateer. A privateer was basically what we would think of as a licensed pirate. That is, a ship licensed by the crown that would go out and prey on enemy shipping. And the captain and crew would be able to keep the treasures garnered, split with the crown. In essence, privateering was a form of adventure. It was a form of patriotism to serve as a privateer. And it also put money in the pockets if you lived. And after a year, if you lived, right. And Paine, fortunately, sailed on a ship that did quite well, and he did survive, and he played an important role in the ship. Given he was a staymaker, he became a sail. You can imagine the skill he had enabled him to repair the sails on the ship. So after a year, I think he figured he had been lucky enough to live, and he had made some money. He left, and Paine really did yearn to educate himself. He really did enjoy school. His two favorite subjects were poetry and science, as I recall, poetry and science. And he headed to London. Now, London at that time was a city of about, I think, 600,000 people. And it was the largest city in the world. And it was, you know, a major port. And there were people from all over the world, a very exciting place. And in London, there was a very, for lack of a better way of putting it, there was a very dynamic, very energetic artisan class, folks who were skilled workers. And they were very proud of their skills and proud of their standing, even though they weren't necessarily well off enough to vote, which required a certain amount of property. They were very proud of their standing in society, and they would organize their, for lack of a better word, their own university, in taverns and pubs and coffee houses. That is, they were themselves ineligible to go to university. Even their kids wouldn't have been able to go. To go to university in England at that time, Oxford or Cambridge, meant you had to be an Anglican, you had to have a certain amount of money, and of course you had to be male.
Sure.
So they would organize these classes, lectures, in the evenings. They would invite, you know, geographers, astronomers, people who had traveled the world, folks who could teach them about science, what was then known as natural philosophy, who could teach them how to improve themselves, in other words, this was their form of autodidactic activity, self-education. And Paine threw himself into this, and he absolutely loved it. And he spent another year in London just literally learning what he could from the lecturers of the day. It's also quite possible at that time that he encountered Benjamin Franklin for the first time. And that will come to bear in his life later. Mm-hmm. Anyhow, at a certain point, he knew he had to face reality. And I'll make the long story short. He goes through the next number of years where he's trying to make a living as a staymaker. It doesn't happen. He marries and loses his wife and infant in childbirth. Yeah. He eventually pursues the exams to become a tax collector, an excise officer. And this goes on and on for some years, and it's a series of mishaps, a series of mistakes, but it's also along the way he's undaunted, and he becomes again all the more educated to the tyranny of English life. He comes to see the degree to which the English government is oppressive. He comes to see the degree to which people are literally exploited and suffering the inequalities of British life.
Right.
And at a certain point, for yet another time, the Excise Commission fires him. And he heads to London, where he meets again with Franklin. And Franklin says to him, now we're in 1774. And Paine, you know, what's he going to do with his life? Franklin urges him to go to America, you know, to start over again. At this time, he's about 37, approaching 38 years of age. And he takes Franklin's advice, and he accepts a letter of introduction from Franklin. So he sets sail in the autumn of 1774 for America without any idea as to what might happen. He knows one thing. America, in many ways, is booming, but it's also in a state of rebellion. Now, given his experiences, his being hired and fired, his difficulties with the British government, he decides pretty much he's not going to get involved in politics. He's going to find a job either as a clerk or as a tutor. But he arrives in Philadelphia, and again, this is a guy who's undaunted, and for whatever reason, maybe just because he has this letter from Franklin, within weeks of his arrival in Philadelphia, he is invited to become the editor of the New Pennsylvania Magazine. Now, he's never been an editor before.
Right.
He has had some writing experience, writing in favor of trying to increase the wages of the excise officers. I mean, he's an experienced, nearly middle-aged man, but editing, you know, he's got away with words, but this is a whole new thing. Nevertheless, he becomes the editor of this magazine, and the magazine becomes the most popular magazine in the colonies. And Paine himself is often writing stories and reports, but he's writing about America in a way that clearly indicates that he has fallen in love with America. Mm-hmm. Now, America at this time has a population of, I think it's 3 million people, 500,000 of whom are African Americans, and most of them are slaves. A lot of folks in these colonies are indentured servants, and he's very much aware that while he's in love with America and sees phenomenal opportunities and possibilities for the Americans, he's also very much aware, as I said, that this is also a land of slavery and servitude.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually writes about he actually calls for the abolition of slavery. And in doing, he gets noticed by a member of the Continental Congress, a guy named Benjamin Rush. And so here's Paine. He's in the New World. He's got a new career. Life is magnificent. But all around him, the colonies are exploding in a state of rebellion. And this leads him to believe, that history hangs in the balance. What happens in America will shape the future of human history.
Mm-hmm.
And in conversations with Benjamin Rush, who obviously picks up on this enthusiasm, Rush says to him, Rush is part of the sort of radical group in the Congress, he says, why don't you call for American independence? Why don't you write and call for American independence? And there's a great little moment there. And Paine looks at him and says, well, why don't you do it? And Rush says, wait, I'm a doctor. I have too much to lose if things go wrong. You have nothing to lose.
Right.
Well, all this proves to Paine is that rich people are rich people, and the rest of us have to watch out for ourselves. But Paine is enthused by the idea. And that summer, he decides he's going to commit himself to writing a pamphlet, which he originally thinks he'll call Plain Truth, and he decides to title Common Sense. And he's encouraged also to do so by Benjamin Franklin's return to Philadelphia. He's living in Philadelphia. And others are contributing pieces to him, that is, elements to encourage his thinking, mm-hmm. documents to encourage his thinking. But he's writing it slowly and carefully. You might say he's sort of bringing together his hatred for British injustices and inequalities. He's bringing together both that sense of that antagonism towards Britain and his love for America. He's bringing together his belief that he's really come to understand as a consequence of living in Philadelphia, where artisans and workers are demanding a greater voice in public life and have, as in all of the colonies, farmers and artisans and others have already pretty much taken over colonial life. They've already staged something of a revolution. They're running these cities by way of committees, even though they're still saying that, you know, they're loyal to the crown. You know, the irony is in all this is that in 1775, even after the rebellion has turned militant, even after Washington is already in the field with an army in New England, it's the case that Americans are still proclaiming that they're British and that they're attached to Britain by sort of, you know, sort of what we call filial ties, that they themselves are, in fact, they claim, the British patriots. They're defending the rights of freeborn Britons against these, you know, against Parliament that wants to subject them to tyranny and slavery. So, but, and Paine sees in all this, as I said, this incredible moment, and he writes Common Sense in many ways to disabuse them, first of all, to disabuse them of any attachment to the king, to disabuse them of any lingering attachment to England, and to show them what they're already doing as Americans. It's as if he's holding up a mirror to Americans and saying, look at what you're already doing. You're already governing yourselves. You're already, in other words, turning yourselves from subjects into citizens. You're already, in essence, turned yourselves from rebels into revolutionaries. But the real punchline in Common Sense is that he shows Americans that they're Americans, that they're not British. You know, people should pick up Common Sense and keep it by their bedside. You know, he explains to them that in spite of their differences across the colonies, in spite of their differences of national background, the fact is that they are American and not British or simply Europeans.
Right.
And the other thing is, in order to really push this argument, he lays out a plan for an independent, democratic America. Now, this is very persuasive because, for example, in Virginia, where you live, okay, farmers, real farmers, not planters, you know, who have others planting for them, slaves or tenant farmers.
Sure.
But farmers themselves, who might often have been Presbyterians, Methodists, or Baptists, they're very hesitant about signing on to any struggle that's going to be led by Anglican gentry like Jefferson or Patrick, well, Mason, or, you know, those kinds of folks. They, you know, those are elite figures, however much, you know, they might be the leaders of the colony. They distrust those folks just as much as the gentry distrust the farmers.
Right.
And similarly, in New York State, farmers distrust the big landowners. And in the big cities, artisans and laborers, they distrust the merchants, and the merchants distrust them. There's an element of this sort of class conflict that's developing during the colonial period.
And that's actually reemerging right now with the distrust in factions of society. But continue. Sorry.
Absolutely. No, I'm going on quite a bit. Well, the point is that Paine, what he tells people, and he writes for the first time ever, a pamphleteer in America actually writes so that working people, farmers and artisans and laborers, can actually understand it. I mean, Jefferson and folks like that wrote many things. And they were beautiful writers, but they wrote for each other. They wrote for them, for the educated. You know, they wrote for the members of the colonial assemblies. They wrote for the gentry, the lawyers, the planters, the merchants. Paine was a working class guy who wrote for everyone.
Right.
He wrote for everyone so that everyone could understand. And what they understood is that if indeed if they launched this revolution, that they could create an America in which they too would have a democratic voice, that they too would be able to determine the direction of public and private life, that in other words, that they didn't need kings, aristocrats, overlords, gentry, you know, priests, preachers. They didn't need people telling them what to do, that they could become themselves all the more truly self-determining citizens of a democratic republic. I mean, this had a revolutionary impact. I mean, within weeks, it was sold out. Within months, it had sold, Common Sense, it sold what's projected to be 120,000 copies, maybe even 150,000. If you put that in terms today, it might have been 15 million copies, 20 million copies. It became, you know, this huge bestseller. And
crazy.
And to his credit, Paine took no royalties. He insisted that all royalties go to buy mittens for Washington's troops. I mean, you know, he was dedicated. He was a committed revolutionary, a committed radical on these questions. I mean, to give you an idea, I looked closely into all of this when I was writing the book. And the story that I really like is the story of John and Abigail Adams and what happens. You know, everyone knows the line, remember the ladies, you know, Abigail telling John, you know, when you go to create this new nation, you remember the ladies, you know, we have no reason to trust you, so you make sure we have a voice in all of this. But what is not often included in that is the degree to which, and I'm convinced it's a significant degree, it was Common Sense by Thomas Paine, that pamphlet, that John Adams himself had bought a few copies of and sent one to Abigail, that she read this pamphlet and said, this is the moment. This is the time in which we can really, really, as Thomas Paine wrote in the pamphlet, start the world over again. And the beauty of it is that she writes to John, you know, remember the ladies, and his response is just wonderful. And they loved each other. They had this incredible affection for each other. But what he writes back is both sort of, you know, affectionate and also filled with anxiety. He says, not you too, meaning, and he says, not half of humankind, too. He says, we've already heard that the slaves are rising in North Carolina, that the students at the universities are challenging their masters, that the artisans are taking control in the towns. And said, in other words, he's listing all of these groups that are rising up, right? Right. And now he said, not you too, meaning, the half of humanity is now demanding its place in history and its place in a possible democratic America. So it's this great moment. And that was the impact that Paine's writing had. So, if for that alone he should warrant a statue on the Mall in Washington, D.C., which, by the way, is sorely missing, right?
It is, for sure. I mean, he really translated all of those ideas into layman's terms for people to not only understand but get on board, because like you said, there was distrust and they didn't understand why these ideas would apply to them and why they should pay attention and rise up and fight alongside. And you said that Paine also believed in universal suffrage for all of those groups that were starting to rise.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. There's an essay that's sometimes attributed to Paine, which argues that women too should have the right to vote. I'm not sure that he wrote that. But one thing I can tell you is that Paine was the closest thing to a late 18th century male feminist that you can imagine. And I'll jump ahead in Paine's life to a pamphlet he wrote in the 1790s. It was titled Agrarian Justice. It was the last of his great pamphlets. He wrote other things, but the last of his great pamphlets. He had gone back to Europe after the American Revolution because he had this design that he had developed for an iron bridge. He wanted to connect Americans north and south, who were often disconnected from each other because of all the rivers that flowed into the Atlantic, and bridges would be ruined by winter weather. So he had this design for an iron bridge, but Franklin finally said to him, look, you'll never find the capital to build the bridge in this country. Go back to Europe, London, Paris, maybe you'll find the money. He goes back to Europe in search of the capital to build the bridge. He never does get the capital, but he ends up, in many ways, starting two more radical movements by being there. In response to the French Revolution and conservative attacks on the Revolution, he writes a pamphlet titled Rights of Man, mm-hmm. which is an argument defending the French Revolution on the basis of the American experience. And this pamphlet becomes, if you like, almost like the Bible of the working class movement in England, which is demanding the right to vote, and it becomes in many ways, not unlike Common Sense, the biggest best-selling thing ever imagined in Europe as a pamphlet. Well, he ends up staying in France much longer than he ever expected, and even served in the French Assembly. In fact, come back and ask me about how he almost died during the French Revolution. But late in the after the Revolution, when he was still in France and he was living, I believe it was with James Monroe, who was then the American ambassador, and his wife, Paine was seriously concerned about the poverty that he saw in Europe, and even thought that, you know, we take these things for granted and we really ought to do something about them. And he had talked a bit about this in Rights of Man. He actually laid out a plan in Rights of Man for Social Security. He is the godfather of American Social Security. But in Agrarian Justice, this is what he does. He says, you know, in order to combat poverty, we need to create national funds. He said, think about it. People who have large land holdings really, really, in one sense, have no right to these holdings. Because as he saw it, God created the earth for all to share. I mean, that's what the creation, he said, was for all of humanity. And those who have a monopoly over landholding, a monopoly of wealth of, in 18th century terms, they have an obligation to pay taxes on this land to the nation, whatever nation they live in, to the community. So he argued that wealthy landholders should pay a tax to the community, and that this fund that's created should be used to combat poverty in this way. It should be given in as stakes, S-T-A-K-E-S, mm-hmm. as stakes to young people when they reach the age of maturity, 16, 18, 21, whatever the age of maturity might be. They should be given these money grants to get a start in life. So whether they, you know, they want to set up a business, they want to buy some land of their own, they want to get an education, they want to set up an enterprise, whatever it might be. Now, the interesting thing here is he said, this is not ever meant to be a charity. This is a right, so that all young men and women on reaching the age of maturity should receive this.
Mm-hmm. Regardless they don't want of, it. Of class. You
know, right. Yeah. Regardless of class. And they can't turn it down. The you know, if you're rich and you don't want it, you have to accept it, and then you can give it back. But you have to accept it, because he never wanted it to be viewed as a charity. Mm-hmm. And so, and what's interesting, and my point to go back to the feminist question is that when he talked about the distribution of this money, he said young men and women, boys and girls. This was a very radical argument. To treat men and women equally in terms of getting a start in life, that's the proof that Thomas Paine was a feminist of his day. And by the way, he was close to the sort of, if you like, the sort of founding figure of modern feminism, Mary Wollstonecraft. They came to know each other very well during the French Revolution in Paris.
Sure. And he was also quoted during the, you said later in the book, during the women's suffrage movement, long after his death. He was kind of an inspiration for those revolutionary ideas as well. I mean, he really, you talk about all the different groups throughout history that he really inspired. So tell us a little bit about that and a little bit about historically, even after his life, how his ideas lived on.
Okay, so there were all of those efforts, as I mentioned, by the, you know, the powerful, the propertied, the prestigious, the pious, all those kind of folks to suppress his memory, because his arguments were so radical. I mean, so radical that literally it launched a new age in human history. They launched a new age in human history. In fact, the funniest thing is that one of the first sort of radical types to pick up on Paine's arguments were folks who were themselves rather antagonistic to his deism. He believed in God, but he didn't believe in organized religion. Those are Christian evangelicals in the 1790s and early 1800s. They read his work. And they found themselves empowered to argue against concentrations of power in their own churches. And in essence, the early radicals like Lorenzo Dow, this itinerant preacher, and others who came out of Methodism, they were all inspired by Thomas Paine. The next group are the free thinkers, inspired by Thomas Paine's attack on organized religion, Age of Reason. And they themselves, you know, the word free thinkers applied to them. Some of them might have been atheists, some of them might have been deists. But the idea was that they believed that we should liberate ourselves from the influence of powerful churches and clerics who might seek to take advantage of us. But truly, the great development in Paine's memory is that working men's movements in the 1820s and the 1830s, known as the working men's parties, they laid claim to Thomas Paine too. And they also laid claim to Jefferson. But they laid claim to Paine's arguments in Common Sense, Rights of Man, and Agrarian Justice to argue for the needs of working men. In essence, pushing the idea, in part, by some, of a redistribution of property. They actually took a step beyond Thomas Paine. Some of them also argued for, you know, taxing the rich in order to make sure that the poor do not become poor and destitute.
Right.
So the Working Men's Party. Next movement beyond that is indeed abolitionists. And many of the abolitionists were serious Christians, so they had some qualms about embracing the arguments of a man such as Thomas Paine, who was a deist. But they couldn't resist his attacks on ideas such as slavery and tyranny and his fundamental belief in the equality of all men and women. And this became then essential, so that William Lloyd Garrison and a host of abolitionists end up quoting Thomas Paine in their newspapers, in their magazines, in their speeches. Similarly, the early suffragists, whose first national convention occurred in 1848, and that's interesting because the women who came into the suffrage movement probably found it strange that they were going to be, again, themselves embracing this kind of sort of deists, radicals, arguments. But Elizabeth Cady Stanton herself embraces Paine in the fullest fashion. She, too, becomes a free thinker. She becomes a feminist. She becomes a radical of her day. The famous duo of Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony. And Cady Stanton herself, who had a family to raise, she stayed home, but she was the great writer of the two of them. Susan B. Anthony became the great speaker. She would take to the road delivering the speeches. And as you mentioned, it was Susan B. Anthony who would regularly quote Thomas Paine, that to the effect of the right to vote is the right which defends all of our other rights. And in 1872, when Susan B. Anthony persuaded the poll keepers, the men who were in charge of the poll, the precinct, the place to vote up in New York State, she convinced them to let her to vote, and it's an amazing thing. And then, of course, she was charged with voting illegally and had to defend herself. And she took to the hustings. She took to the platforms, arguing, quoting Thomas Paine, "The right to vote is the right that defends all the other rights." So, and then we get the populace, these agrarian populace here in the Midwest, from Oklahoma and Arkansas all the way north through the plains into the upper Midwest. These folks discovered Thomas Paine, and as they organized their granges and their associations and eventually the People's Party, the men who they turned to quote, Thomas Paine, the populace often had these big revival-like meetings, these grand festivals out on the prairies, and their speakers, their lecturers, would quote Thomas Paine, and some of them got elected to Congress. So here, over and over again, Thomas Paine's words find their way into the American imagination. Oh, by the way, Thomas Paine's works were never out of print in America. Never out of print, in spite of all of the efforts of conservatives to have it otherwise.
That's fantastic. And you said people actually continued to celebrate his birthday.
Yeah, well, I should go back. If we go back now into the 1850s, in 1848, there were revolutions all across the European continent, and it was significant that, they all were defeated, one by one, they were defeated. But the German revolutionaries, the liberals, the progressives, and the radicals, who rose up, many of them were determined to come to America in defeat because they had read Thomas Paine's Common Sense and Rights of Man in German. And their sense of America was a place in which they might be able to realize the democratic aspirations that they had in Germany, but which had been crushed. This is the 1848 revolution. So, and I live in the great German-American state of Wisconsin now. I grew up in the New York area. Well, German migration, immigration to the United States between the late 1840s and the 1870s was in the millions. And it spread from the hill country of Texas to the countryside and cities of the upper Midwest, Chicago, Milwaukee, the Twin Cities in Minnesota, out into the countryside. Now, it's interesting that, and how do we know that Thomas Paine was their champion? Well, here in Wisconsin, both in rural Wisconsin, in the town of Sauk Prairie, and in Milwaukee, every year on January 29th, or the weekend closest to it, free thinkers would organize Thomas Paine birthday parties in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the Turner Hall. The Turners were societies of liberal-thinking German-Americans who would organize their own classes, educational centers. They would organize gymnastics. They would train their kids to both the mind, to educate the mind and the body, and they were thrilled by the words of Thomas Paine. And this is the interesting thing to me. So every year around January 29th, they would celebrate Paine's birthday. I got to get a drink of water.
Sure.
And they would hold these big festivities. They would have speeches, toasts, huge dinner parties and balls, you know, big dancing festive occasions. And they would get hundreds and hundreds of people to turn out. They were the big occasion, and you can imagine in Wisconsin, late January is as cold and snowy as you can, it's...
Right,
it's,
yeah.
But people turned out. And then, by the way, as a footnote to that, I got to tell you, the best descriptions of all of these parties were actually in a dissertation written in the 1920s by a Catholic nun who was fascinated by these parties. And the parties continued from the 1850s all the way through to around 1920. And Turner Hall, at least in Milwaukee, was one of the central sites, but they happened all the way all across the country. I shouldn't say only in Wisconsin. They were big in New York, in Chicago. I think there were also events held, regularly in Cincinnati. One of the things, Shannon, that I'm sort of overflowing with this stuff, but one of the things that I want people to realize is that here we are talking about a man whose memory was supposedly suppressed, that he had disappeared from the American imagination. And yet, workers' organizations and labor unions, farmers' organizations and the Populist Party, women's suffrage organizations, free-thinking groups, and every kind of group imaginable that wanted to lay claim to the revolution in favor of making America freer, more equal, and more democratic, they rediscovered Thomas Paine and they kept his life and labors alive in American life. This went all the way through the 19th century. And then in the 20th century, Paine is discovered again by socialists, by labor unionists, by even... Here's a funny thing, you might get a kick out of this. In 1930, a Catholic magazine actually celebrated Thomas Paine, which is, by the way, almost unimaginable considering he was a deist. But why do they celebrate him? Because they said, you know, Thomas Paine is the one who argued right away in Common Sense. It's right there in Common Sense for separation of church and state. And here in America, Catholic freedoms were guaranteed by that separation of church and state. And they honored Thomas Paine for having been the man who first called for that separation of church and state in the pamphlet Common Sense. So there was this far more widespread enthusiasm for Paine than people ever gave public, the elites, they feared his memory.
Well, let's talk a little bit about why people were trying to erase him and why people decided to try to tarnish his reputation, to erase him from the revolution and from the formation of America. What were the reasons behind that?
Well, I mean, for a start, even during the revolution itself, folks like John Adams, let me use Adams as an example because we spoke of him before. I mean, John Adams was, without a doubt, a radical. There was no question he was a radical. But his vision of an independent America was that it would be a republic, not a democracy. Adams didn't trust aristocrats, and he didn't trust ordinary people. And in many ways, even though he was a radical on the question of independence, and when he read Common Sense, he embraced Paine's arguments for independence, but he truly feared, he really worried about Paine's arguments for democracy. He worried about the anarchy and the chaos that might ensue. Mm-hmm. It really is the case that in many ways, Adams represents the first voice of conservative America, and Paine represents the first voice of radical and progressive America. Mm-hmm. And so, you've got folks who loved Paine's call for independence, but they feared the idea of democracy. And let's face it, I mean, the Declaration is also a radical document. Paine's influence is expressed there itself. Life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness.
Sure.
The Constitution, when the conveners of the convention met, they wanted to literally suppress democracy as much as they could. I mean, they were seriously worried. Look, in Virginia, they had to figure out what would happen if, in fact, there was a slave rebellion. They needed to know that they could depend on a national government to defend them. Mm-hmm. In Massachusetts, they worried about the wealthy of Boston worried about the farmers of Western Massachusetts, who were constantly trying to resist the taxes and the debts, repaying the debts that they owed these wealthy merchants. So there was this fear of what working people might want in a constitution, and they saw it happening in the states during the 1780s. The Constitutional Convention was held in good part not only to unify a very sort of disrupted federation, but also in many ways to guarantee that the property would have a greater say in public life than those without property.
Mm-hmm.
However, there was a historian who passed away several years ago, a guy named Al Young, and he said, look, if you look closely at the Constitution, there's no doubt about the effort of the writers of the Constitution to contain, to limit democracy. But it's also the case, you can imagine, that even in the convention itself, Paine's words and Paine's people were felt. So, for example, the document acknowledges democracy in its opening words, we the people. It also, at no point in the document, specifically specifies property requirements
mm-hmm.
for elective. I mean, in many ways, it's both a document intended to limit radical democracy at the time, but it also cannot help, because these members of the Constitutional Convention knew they could only get away with so much. They had to acknowledge the democratic struggles of the past. But let's not forget, in the 19th century, as American manufacturing and American agriculture and American industry develops, as property begins to accumulate, when working people grab hold of Thomas Paine, they're calling for the right to organize labor unions, to have a voice both in politics and all the more in the workplace. And of course, when wealthy figures look around and they hear these guys quoting Thomas Paine, they recognize the danger in that democratic voice. And, you know, let's suppress the memory of it. I mean, one thing to understand is ruling classes do their damnedest to keep people from remembering the things that might inspire them.
Mm-hmm.
To try to convince them that the way things are is the way it has to be, rather than to encourage them that the way things are is the way that they want it, as opposed to the way most people really would like to have it. So, I mean, Paine is the kind of guy who spoke and enthused people with democratic spirit. And even though he wasn't around in the face of industrial development, in the face of all of these kinds of social changes of the 19th century, in the face of, you know, if you like, the making of modern America, his voice was. And if you're an American in the 19th century, and look, if you're an American in the 20th century, in the 21st century, we all look back to the revolution. We look to validate our cause in the revolution. And when progressive movements discover the voice of Thomas Paine and realize the degree to which the revolution itself was inspired by that voice, they harness it, they use it, and as they're doing it, those with power, those with, you know, property, they're going to seriously wonder whether it's a good idea to teach Thomas Paine in the schools.
Sure. Well, and even outside of the country, when he went back to Europe, his ideas were viewed as so dangerous that he was tried in absentia in England. Tell us a little bit about that.
Right. Well, in the radical movement of the late 18th century in England, which was in many ways a movement of middle class and working class people demanding the right to vote. I mean, in England, maybe one out of every 20 men had the right to vote. I mean, inequality and injustice in Britain may not have been quite as gruesome as it was in France or in Turkey, but it was truly gruesome if you had to live in it. And people were getting organized, and they found in common sense, but especially Rights of Man, the pamphlet Paine wrote during the French Revolution, they found arguments against the king. They found arguments against aristocracy. They found arguments against inequality. People came to see in Thomas Paine's words an argument that says, we don't need overlords, we can govern ourselves. So anyhow, so at a certain point, it was pretty obvious to the royal authorities that they needed to do something to shut down this voice of Thomas Paine. And the story is told that they issued a warrant for his arrest, and that it was William Blake, the poet, who was a friend of Thomas Paine, who first heard about this arrest warrant and warned Paine. And basically, Paine at that moment realized he had to escape, and he headed to the South Coast, and he took the first boat he could get over to France. And then, of course, the funny thing is, he arrives in France, and he's celebrated as a hero, by the French people, because his voice in Rights of Man stimulated so much of their struggles against their own kings, their own king and aristocrats. So in England, even, not unlike in the United States, eventually, Thomas Paine's name is not exactly celebrated in most quarters. However, it became, if you like, one of the central voices heard by working people, by socialists, by labor unionists in the 19th century. I went back to England 3 years ago. I studied as a graduate student in England. I went back to England a few years ago to attend a conference on Paine's memory. I was very honored to do it because it was my book that had stimulated the British to start asking questions about Paine's memory in Britain. And I gave this talk. And what amazed me is, of course, the fact that the folks who gave the other papers all were recounting these great stories of how Paine had indeed been sustained as a champion of radical democratic thought all the way through the 19th century into the 20th century. And, you know, I don't know if people realize that there are statues to Thomas Paine here in America. Mm-hmm. There's one in South Jersey. There's one in
I think you said they're Morristown.
Wait, there's one in Morristown. There's one going up now in Fort Lee. It's either going to go up this autumn or the autumn after.
Oh, here in Virginia.
And in Virginia?
Is Fort Lee
this is Fort Lee, New Jersey.
Oh,
sorry.
Okay.
Oh, I'd love to imagine Thomas Paine.
I was thinking that would be strange.
That would be great. That would be wonderful.
We still have the Civil War monuments up around here. So.
Well, you know, what's funny is George Washington and Thomas Paine, for most of their lives, had been friends. I mean, there's a whole story about about the falling out, which we don't have time for. But Washington realized just how important and how valuable Thomas Paine's pen was to the Revolution. Look, George Washington never even thought about independence itself or spoke publicly about it until his own troops were reading Common Sense and compelled him, or at least compelled him, to think seriously about it. So Washington had every appreciation for Thomas Paine through the course of the Revolution. And after the Revolution, Washington wanted to help Paine get a fresh start. I mean, Paine had no money to speak of after the Revolution. So Washington tried to convince the House of Burgesses is your assembly? Is that what it's called?
It's House of Delegates now, yes.
House of Delegates. So once upon a time, it was called.
It was the Burgesses, yes.
He tried to get the Virginia government to give Paine some money or some land, but it was never going to happen because there were Virginians who remembered that Thomas Paine opposed slavery, and there was just no way that they were going to give way. So Washington actually did persuade the members of the state assembly in New York to give him a little bit of money, excuse me, to give him a little bit of money and a little farm up in New Rochelle, New York. There is a statue there. The first of the American statues actually is in New Rochelle, New York. It's a sort of column with a bust of Paine on the top. You know, there was, I think it was Andrew Jackson who later said, somebody like Jackson said, there should be a bust of Paine in every town and city of America. It's really fascinating to think about the fact that when I was growing up, I knew about Paine because of my grandfather. And even now, these last 20 years, whenever I tell someone that I've got this interest in Paine, or I've written a book about Paine, or I try to hawk my book and say, hey, you should go buy a copy, that they often say, you know, I don't know much about him, but my brother or my uncle. It's as if in every family there was somebody who had this fascination for Paine. Hey, I'll give you an example. A few weeks ago, a member of the board of trustees of our campus here in Wisconsin, in Green Bay, called me to say that his doctor really wanted to meet me because he was a tremendous enthusiast for Thomas Paine. And I said, yeah, that'd be great. I'm happy to do it. And he said, but really what turned him on to Thomas Paine were his two high school daughters. I said, really wonderful. So we met for about 2 hours over coffee last week. I had a terrible cold. He was a doctor. He said the patriotic enthusiasm would drive away my cold. So, yeah. Meanwhile, I got even sicker the next day. I hope they didn't catch it. Oh, God, terrible. But here are these people all around us who actually have this enthusiasm for Paine, but we don't really often know about it. You know, we don't hear about it because conservatives would rather we forget. But then again, these last 20 years, 30 years, ever since Reagan started quoting Payne, conservatives have done their best to lay claim to him. But they don't lay claim really to the radical Payne. They don't lay claim to the Payne, really, who believed in combating inequality, who believed in creating Social Security, who believed in taxing the rich to provide scholarships and a start in life to young people. That's not the Payne they want. They want the Payne who early in Common Sense says, you know, government is always an evil and society, you know, is a good. And all Payne was saying was that the governments we know of Europe are evil. But people generally have a democratic spirit in them. Mm-hmm. And really what we need to do is build a government out of that spirit, as opposed to build a government from the top down from kings and aristocrats.
And he took care to separate social and economic equality. Tell me a little bit about that.
Help me understand your question a bit more.
That there was a difference between social equality and economic equality, and that they didn't have to be approached the same way.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I would have put it in those terms, but and maybe I'll answer and you'll tell me if I've done it right or done it justice to your question. Thomas Paine was never a socialist. Mm-hmm. He never argued in favor of taking property away from people. Okay, that he didn't do. Even though later socialists and others used Paine to make those arguments, which, by the way, are not completely outrageous if you think about the fairness of an economy and the need to sustain that fairness. But nevertheless, Paine, however, as I said, did believe, he was what we would think of as a pioneering social democrat. In other words, if people are accumulating property that might threaten the well-being of the community, the stability of democracy, the progress of democratic life, we need to tax them to assure that inequality doesn't become so great as to undermine and subvert democracy. Mm-hmm. So in essence, he believed in civil equality, you know, all equal under the law, political equality, all citizens having the right to vote. And he believed in a social equality that might even approach a question of economic equality, in that he believed that you really did need to combat gross inequalities by taxing the rich to enable others to get a start in life. And also, by the way, he was the founding father of the idea of Social Security. You tax the rich, you set up benefits, and even you tax yourselves in order to make sure that in old age, you're not going to starve, go penniless, and be homeless.
Right. Right. Well, our time is winding down, but I want to read a short quote and get your thoughts on kind of how this sums up Paine's ideas and how it relates to America today. It is yet too soon to write the history of the revolution. And he said that regarding the events of 1776, but it still is true. So tell me a little bit about how his revolutionary ideas still impacts American society to this day.
Well, they're there. You know, I believe in something called cultural memory, that we carry the spirit of Thomas Paine within us. We all do some, you know, you say to people, we have it in our power to begin the world over again. And they say, oh, Americans themselves kind of respond to that. You say to people, of course, these are the words of Jefferson, that we all have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And they say, yes. You say to them, this is a country that is to be governed by we, the people, and that we have certain rights as spelled out in that First Amendment. Now, these ideals, this, if you like, that promise of America, that's what defines not just the meaning of America, but what it means to be an American. The problem today, however, is that we've entered into this moment in which we really are so divided. We're so divided that we find ourselves divided not only in politics, but by gross inequalities. And if you look around the country and you look at the degree to which conservatives are doing their damnedest to contain and turn back the democratic advances of these past, 70, 80 years from the New Deal 1930s, the Great Society 1960s, I mean, on, then, and we know that people are resisting. We know that. I mean, actually, if you think about the 2016 election, think about how it was possible for a social democrat, someone who really was making arguments that Thomas Paine might have made, how close such a man, I'm referring to Bernie Sanders, came to winning the nomination. I mean, we're in this moment where indeed it's too soon to write the history of the revolution. How's that?
Mm-hmm. It's so true. It's both frightening and exciting at the same time that we can live based on ideas and come back to them. I mean, the American experiment is an experiment, but it's kind of a test of the will of man and the heart of man at the same time. So it's also, well, Harvey, I can't thank you enough for talking to me today, for coming on the show, for writing this book and reminding everyone or letting them know who Thomas Paine is if they didn't know, because he really made such a difference in the history of America and the formation of America. So thank you for that.
Well, and thank you. And I'll apologize to you and everyone else. As you could probably tell, my enthusiasm for Paine sometimes overpowers my articulateness or my capacity to speak clearly about him. I just get so carried away because everyone should read Thomas Paine's Common Sense. They'll find it's like reading a letter from an old friend, and it'll help them remember who they are. And of course, I'd be very happy if people read Thomas Paine and The Promise of America, my own book, and I'd be happy to hear from them. You know, I'm on Twitter at HarveyJK.
Excellent, excellent, and they can link from there, and I will also in the broadcast page have a link to your book. So I think you articulated the ideas and the history wonderfully. I mean, it's the passion for the topic really makes it even more interesting. So it's hearing your voice and hearing your excitement makes the words jump out as even more strong than they do even in the book, which is riveting. So thank you so much, and hopefully I'll have you back on the show again. I've loved having you twice, and I'd love to have you back on because it's always interesting and fun to talk philosophy and theology and America with you.
Oh, thanks. You're great. Thank you very much.
Well, for Our Lives with Shannon Fisher, this is Shannon Fisher. See you next time.